This is episode number 795 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Wizard cutting shows from their current schedule, Ace Universe starting up new shows with familiar names, the return of Jean Grey, New York Comic Con, and Bing Comic Con. Our comics this week will be Action Comics number 987, Venomverse number 1, and Marvel Generations Sam Wilson, Steve Rogers. And of course, our Summer of Dread wraps up this week with our summer watching project, the 2012 Dread movie.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everyone to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the G-man adorned Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
You look good. You sound like you feel good. It is beautiful outside.
It finally, you know what? If you would have asked me yesterday, I would have been miserable.
Yep.
Because we have been in the middle of a heat wave here in New England, and I am ready for fall.
Yep.
Just bring it. Bring me the crisp fall air. Bring me the crinkling leaves. I like to wake up in the morning and have that nice borderline cold morning air. This is my favorite time of year, and I feel like we're being robbed of it because we are at the end of September. As we record this right now, I believe it's the 28th of September. And here we are coming off of three 90-plus degree days.
Yeah, and I know that our complaints are nothing compared to everybody dealing with things in Florida and Puerto Rico and
Texas.
Oh,
of course
not. But to us, it's just showing that the weather is completely screwed up and that God is angry. And all these comments, all
that is certainly
things,
one theory.
All these things, like we've heard a lot of things and we've seen movies and read comics and all these stories about how, and I think this was part of, was this in The Kingsman? But basically saying that the virus is happening right now and the world is expelling the anger and the hatred and that and the fury and the sickness. And that's why we're getting all these tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, and weird weathers.
That took an interesting turn, fact that it's been warm in New England for the past couple of days. So, okay. All right. Well, let's talk about – I have a couple of very interesting news stories today. It seems like lately we have been talking about conventions.
Yes.
Like nonstop. And we're going to talk about them some more today because, Matthew, Wizard World will produce 14 shows in 2017, down 8 from the 22 that it said it was planning for the year as of last month. The reduction includes 5 markets where the company had planned new shows in 2017. Launches in those markets are now planned for the fall of 2018.
Or never.
Now, and we'll talk about that in a second because as far back as I can remember, the Wizard slate of shows has never been stable.
Never.
It always changes. It's kind of like how when Mike Carbonaro used to put up the New York Comic Book Marketplace or the Big Apple Con and have Stan Lee and
Jim Lee
and every big name artist or a creator there. Every time he posted for a new show, the biggest creators in the world were going to be there.
Yeah.
And miraculously, somehow they didn't make it there by the time that the show sort of came up. But in any case, Wizard World has hosted 12 shows to date and plans just 2 for quarter 4, Oklahoma City and Austin. The cuts will give Wizard a chance to retool. It's been bleeding cash on declining sales per show. This, by the way, this is from the ICV2 site. Bleeding cash on declining sales per show this year with a $2.2 million loss in quarter 2. The 2018 schedule includes 6 new markets, including the 5 where the launch had been planned for 2017. New shows marked with an asterisk are in the back half of the year. So the 2018 schedule includes New Orleans, St. Louis, Cleveland, Portland, Philadelphia, Des Moines, Iowa, Columbus, Ohio, Boise, Idaho, Chicago, Madison, Wisconsin, Oklahoma City, Austin, Texas, and then Biloxi, Mississippi, Montgomery, Alabama, Peoria, Illinois, Springfield, Missouri, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So they are – which the irony of this post is that they have cut 8 shows from this year's schedule but they are going ahead and telling you that they are going to be having all of these shows now in 2018, which to me is just the precursor to a post 6 months from now where they tell you that those shows aren't happening at all.
Much like we have seen. I mean, Wizard does a great job keeping themselves in the news every 6 or 7 months.
They
However,
do.
These aren't the reasons you
Correct.
Want to be in the news.
It's never the good. Although if they are operating under the assumption that no publicity is bad publicity, then they're doing all right.
And as a marketing guy, that is the most stupid statement in the entire world because there is some serious bad publicity. And
manage to keep coming back into the conversation. I can't remember a year where we've talked about Wizard World as much as we've talked about them this year, but or even over the past year and a half. But the fact that they I almost think that they do this on purpose as a market test.
Yes.
Like so I think what they're doing in most cases, which in that way, actually, you should give them more credit because it's actually smarter than it sounds.
Yep.
Because it's, essentially, if what they're doing is they say, OK, so for 2018, we're going to announce 20 shows. We're going to announce them in markets that we've never been in before. We're going to announce them in markets that there hasn't even been a comic show in before. Mm. And we're going to throw it out there. Let's see what the reaction is on social media. Let's see what the reaction is on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Let's see how many people are coming to our site and clicking on get more information about those shows. And they can kind of judge over the first few months of the year, like, okay, well, it seems like the show that we had planned for this particular city, we're not getting much of a response on. Nobody's excited about it on Twitter. Nobody's talking about it on Facebook. Nobody's coming to our site looking to see if tickets are still on sale for that particular show. Why don't we bump that one? But these two shows that we planned, we're getting a great response on from social media. So, okay, we'll go ahead and do these ones. So if they're using it as sort of market research, but I think the problem is they're playing with their own credibility, of which they have little to begin with.
Yeah, they're shot. It's shot right now.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Matthew, and that's a great segue into our second story. This is from the Comics Beat website, which everyone knows that I absolutely love. We've been telling you for a while now that the Seamus brothers, Garib and Steven, were looking to get back into the convention game.
They were part of the Wizard family.
Thank you, Matthew, for that context. And they are back with Ace Universe.
Oh, great.
Garib, founder of Wizard Magazine and the Wizard World shows, got out of the con game years ago to pursue his art career. That might have been the cover story, but there was a lot of stuff going on at that particular time. The whole ending of that relationship was pretty much a disaster.
It was. It couldn't have been any worse. And again, no press is good press. That was bad press.
Steven stuck on with Wizard World until he was bounced amid some ugly legal maneuverings. That was all settled a while ago, but word on the street was that Steven had good relationships with a lot of the top celebrities and was talking with them about starting a new line of cons. And now that time is here, and that line of cons is here. Ace Universe, the first show is planned for December 8th through the 10th at the NYCB Live, the area around the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum on Long Island, New York. And then they're moving to Glendale, Arizona on the 13th through the 15th of January. The Long Island date is the same weekend as the Walker Stalker Con in New Jersey, which pretty much means it's game on between those two shows. The Long Island venue is a site of the Long Island Comic Con, Eternal Con, held in the summer, and the date is a week after the Winter Con in Queens, so as always, some mini turf wars going on there. As opposed to the current Wizard World brand, which is scaling down to smaller venues and a potential 40-show roster, the Ace Universe brand is a lot more 2017, with arena-sized events, live streaming of all events, and a guest roster that includes Gal Gadot, Henry Cavill, Jason Momoa, Ezra Miller, and other current DCEU and MCU stars.
For now.
But what's interesting about this, because when I first read this, and this is probably a good week old or something, when I first read this, same as you, my initial thought was, holy crap, these guys are starting a new line of cons. This is amazing.
Yep.
Because Wizard is falling apart with the stuff that they're doing and scaling down, and these guys are jumping back into the ring when all we've been talking about for the past year is how the con bubble is about to burst.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically what's happening with cons right now is like what was happening with the speculation market of comics in the early 90s. Like, it feels like it's going to crash tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's at least my personal opinion of, I think, like, where it feels like we're at right now. These guys are jumping in. Now, what's interesting about this is that whether they succeed or fail, this Ace Universe initiative, some of the things that they've talked about already that they're planning to do with their shows, to me, are things that every other show should be copying. So every other comic promoter, listen, if you're not doing this already. One of the things that they're going to do at these shows, because they're going to be in arenas, and we've been in some, I would say, local arenas lately for some of the shows that we've been to. They are going to do things like broadcast all of the panels on the Jumbotron, so that if you're standing in line to meet a creator and you can't get to the panel that you wanted to see this afternoon, that panel will now be playing on the Jumbotron. While you, no matter where you are in the venue, you'll be able to watch it on the Jumbotron, on TVs, wherever you are. So if you can't get into the panel room or you got something else going on, you can see what's happening. That to me right there is humongous.
Waiting in line for a creator for hours and hours, dude. Look up and watch
a
panel.
How many times have we been in a situation where we are at our table and we cannot go to a panel? And being able to, luckily, when I was at Connecticut Horror Fest a couple weeks ago, I was close enough to where the panels were happening that I could hear them going on, and I could hear what Tom Atkins and Adrian Barbeau were talking about and stuff like that. But the notion that you'll be able to see the panels that are happening from wherever you are in the entire convention center, awesome. Flat out awesome. The other thing I believe they're doing, and it doesn't go into detail here, is you are going to be able to see some of that stuff live streamed on TV. So I don't know if you're going to be able to buy, I'm assuming they're going to charge you for that, but let's say that you can buy a virtual ticket. So I can't go to this one in Long Island, but if I buy a virtual ticket for, I don't know, let's hope it's reasonable. Let's say $10 to buy a virtual ticket to be able to live stream all of the panels from that weekend. I would pay $10 to see a fall convention slate of panels. I mean, they're going to be the same where, like, if they go to New York Comic Con and they go there and stuff like that. But to see the cast of the Justice League having a panel on a weekend in the fall before the movie comes out, I'd pay $10 to live stream the panels that are happening there. Or if there's a couple of creators that I really am into that I know are doing panels there, or a couple of panels that maybe I've missed at New York Comic Con every year, but they're doing a similar panel here. So those types of things, I like where these guys' heads are at in terms of the programming piece of it, which you and I often talk about is the piece that gets the short shrift when it comes to conventions. The idea of them having a celebrity-heavy convention and jumping in the pool with all of these other celebrity-heavy conventions to me seems ludicrous.
Yes.
But I like some of the things that they're doing with the programming. So I'm, to me, they've just become one of the more interesting sort of outfits to watch the rest of this year and into early next year, to see if when these conventions start to launch in December and January, they're going to make a splash, and if any of the things that they're doing are going to get picked up by other places. And that's not to say that no one else is live streaming stuff. I know that other cons have live streamed things. Maybe other cons have done the whole Jumbotron thing and done that. And if you have, awesome. But to me, those seemed like things that are either new or not being done universally at this point, and they seem very simple and kind of a one-on-one thing. Like, why isn't everybody doing that?
I think the scary part of that is that the Sheamus brothers have a not so great reputation in the industry right now. Like, they, you know, Garib left Wizard among problems, issues, all sorts of things. Steven, is that the brother?
Steven was the one that stayed.
And Steven stayed, but then he got bounced out of the show side of it because there was a lot of questions on things going on. That's not the here nor there of what I'm saying. But it is going to be tough for those guys to start something in a time when the market is so oversaturated, not to mention they are almost doing what the Wizard thing, the Wizard model was. Look for a show, plop it right in the middle of when there's other shows, make people decide, thin out the herd, and then we'll move in. That's kind of what Wizard did for a little while. And it seems like with Walker Stalker going on right now, you're not going to get people that, if they're going to Walker Stalker, they're not going to go to the other show. But you're not helping the situation. It is.
To throw your hat in the ring against the arguably the most popular cable television show of all time.
Yep. And I question, it's one of those things where, you know, you're kind of questioning. And then the Wizard thing that I was thinking about too is that it almost sounds like the scene, and this is Spinal Tap, one of the greatest movies of all time, when the band had their concert in Boston canceled. And then they were going over the itinerary of the next shows. Or, yeah, we got moved out of the arena. Now we're in the club with a puppet show. It sounds a lot like that, you know, yeah, we don't want to play Boston. It's not a big college town anyway. That kind of thing where, hey, we're going to start dropping shows in Austin or these big cities, but man, we're going to Biloxi.
Yeah.
And not anything against Biloxi, but when I look at the world, I tend to look at it in sports terms. And, you know, if you can't be in the minor leagues, I mean, we live in a minor league city. Springfield is a minor league sports town. That's how I kind of look at it. But if you're not going to be in Boston, you're not going to be in Springfield, then you're going to be in the East Coast Hockey League, which are those smaller towns.
Yep.
And good for them because, you know, a lot of those smaller shows and smaller towns are where it's at. But it's just, it almost seems like, oh my gosh, we're holding on again. And you seem to have read that story every year for the last 3 years.
Well, I just think it's fascinating that these guys are coming in at a time where it feels like it's about to fall apart.
Yeah.
And, but at least they're coming in with what they're packaging as fresh ideas. You know, their whole thing is, we're going to go into arenas. We're not going to go into convention centers. We're going to go into arenas now. So we're going to provide a, almost like in the round, they're taking the Def Leppard route. They're going, they want to provide the in the round experience where no matter where you are in this arena, you're going to be able to experience the best stuff of the con, which is interesting, right? I mean, we've seen people go into hockey venues over the past year. Like we've, in the past couple months, I've been to two shows in hockey venues. And there is, if you use that venue correctly, there is something to be said for that venue. Obviously, we're talking about larger arenas, but I think there's potential there. I definitely think there's potential for these cons embracing the digital aspect of this stuff more. I mean, I don't know what New York Comic Con does with that, but it would be interesting to see. Like, at this point, when tickets sell out for a show like New York Comic Con, if there was a $10 streaming pass that you could buy where they just did basically a live feed, and I know that, I think they do the panel, like the stage A panels or what, I think they do the bigger ones like you can watch, and I'm not sure if it's free or not, but interesting stuff with that. So man, lots of stuff going on in the con space. I would love to talk to, I don't know if we'll be able to do it with this number of shows that we have left, but I would love to talk to, and I'm sure we will talk to, like Mitch, who obviously is putting together Terrificon and has really carved out a great show for himself there with a great balance of talent and celebrities and comics and media and stuff like that. I'm sure there's a lot of chatter going on in promoter town right now about what this is meaning for everything. Yep. So I would be interested to hear that. But let's move on from that, Matthew. Let's talk about Jean Grey.
Let's talk about her.
Now, did we do the Dark Phoenix saga?
Yes, we
as
did.
As a reading project?
We did that or 3 years into the project.
Okay, so we did that. So, well, Marvel Comics is bringing back Jean Grey.
Oh, I thought she was back.
Well, I think it's the younger, time-displaced version. Matthew Rosenberg, who has worked on Secret Warriors and Punisher, will revive the original Jean Grey in Phoenix Resurrection.
Oh.
This 5-issue series will feature work from 5 different artists. The first issue, which is drawn by artist Lionel Yu, will be in stores on December 27th. Art Adams provides a variant cover for the issue. Jean Grey died more than a decade ago in Grant Morrison's run on New X-Men. Since, a time-displaced and younger version of the character has been appearing in Marvel titles. Few details on how Rosenberg is resurrecting the character were offered. This is over again at ICV2. The return is part of the Marvel Legacy Initiative and will undoubtedly be related to the importance of the character in the X-Men films. Jean Grey will be the focus of the next film, X-Men Dark Phoenix, which will debut on November 2nd, 2018. So Dark Phoenix is the next storyline for the X-Men cinematic universe, and now we are getting the original Jean Grey coming back in the comic books, which I think would have had a bigger impact, at least to me, had the younger Jean Grey not been running around in Marvel Comics for at least the past 2 years now.
Yeah, because we've had a Jean Grey. She's right. And it's been a great character, and I really enjoy the fact that people don't know how to talk to her and tread very carefully around her because they're worried about what's going to happen. And there was a great generations of the two Jean Greys meeting, which I thought was one of the better books that has come out in that. But it was interesting when you said that she died almost a decade ago in the Grant Morrison story arc, which was a great story arc. It was the only time I was ever really reading the X-Men when Phil Jimenez was drawing it. But you can almost go back and say, but before that, she died 10 years before that. And then she died 10 years before that. And then she first died. So If the story's well done, I don't care.
Again, it's tough, dude, right? Because like with this Marvel Legacy thing, they're bringing old traditional nostalgic characters, events, and storylines sort of back into the fold. So you kind of knew that that was coming. On the other hand, because we've seen this sort of, you know, wash, rinse, repeat cycle happen over and over again, it's tough to think like that this is the last time. But again, if this is their, if this is Marvel saying, and they want us to believe this, even though we know it's not true, that this is the reset, like this is it, man. We're resetting the characters that we need to reset. We're reestablishing the Marvel universe in the way that it's going to be for years and years and years and years to come. So, you know, this is the last time we're going to do the Jean Grey thing.
Yep.
Because then she's going to come back and she's going to be here. But trust us, this is the way it's going to be from now on. And it's like, I know they would love it if that could be the case, because if Legacy is the most successful thing ever and everybody loves the status quo of the Marvel universe and stuff like that. But it's just impossible with the way that the comics landscape works today for that to be the last time.
Yeah. And I did not realize they were doing a Dark Phoenix movie, which I'm very excited about.
Yes, that's whatever the next, whenever the next one is, I think they, what did they say, 2019 that it was coming out, then is going to be the Dark Phoenix thing.
Good.
Which, I mean, I've seen every other one so far. I'll be seeing that one.
Yep.
So there you go. That's all I got for news, Matthew. So before we get into our comics this week, oh, you know what? A couple other things about news. I do have one other bit of news. I have the fact that you are going to New York Comic Con.
Yes, I am.
So as people listen to this, we might have one more week before that comes up, I think, but you are going to be at New York Comic Con. Are you going for the whole weekend?
I will be there the entire weekend. Monarch Comics is making me stay, so no coming home Friday night and going back Sunday.
So you will be at booth 2125. So yes. If you're going to New York Comic Con, you'll be able to see Matthew at the Monarch Comics booth, which is right on the show floor, not in Artist Alley. It's booth 2125. You will be able to see Matt all weekend.
All weekend. I will be not leaving that table at all, except maybe to go get pizza slices.
So you'll have the Doctor Who book.
Yes.
You'll have the Monkey CC Monkey book.
I'll have that one, and I will have the
Comicopolypse.
Comicopolypse I will have, and I will also be making the show con debut of UFO, your favorite band's favorite band.
There you go. So
very excited.
You will have that book as well. And I believe, and you'll have to snag a copy of this for me, I believe that Vin is planning on putting out the second issue of Monarch Comics Chronicles.
Yes.
And in that second issue, I believe I have a short story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know he's been working on that one for a while. So I think so. So you have to snag me one of those when you go there. So that's coming up. And then at the end of October, there is the Bing Comic Con. So if you're in the Springfield area on the 28th of October at Trinity Church on Sumner Avenue in Springfield, we will be having the Bing Con. And what's cool about that is I just saw that they announced that artist Matt Smith is going to be there, who worked on Lake of Fire, which was that story from Image that we talked about. I reviewed a few of those issues on the show. It was like the medieval storyline that was super cool, that kind of added a tinge of sort of sci-fi to it that I really, really, really liked. So that's cool. I'm looking forward to meeting him at that show. And of course, that's our local show. And you just announced that there's one coming in Westfield?
Yeah, it's at the library. I still have not gotten the details, but it's on a Thursday. I'll put it up on the website, put it up on the on our Facebook pages. Westfield, the bookstore in Westfield State.
Yep.
Westfield State University.
That's it was college when I went there, but it has since changed to university.
Yeah, so the Westfield State University is going to be doing a four-hour little comic book show in the bookstore. And I was asked to help out with that, and I said, you know what, I kind of want to be involved in this, so I will be there. And it's a Thursday, I think it's the third Thursday of the month, I want to say the 19th.
Uh-huh.
And it's from 11 o'clock to 4 p.m. Now, interesting, because those are very weird hours for a show of what we kind of do.
But it's aimed at the students.
It's aimed at the students.
It's for them as they're going in between classes to stop in and stuff like that. So that's pretty forward thinking of the school to try to bring that there, because there's not a lot of stuff that's directly targeted toward the students.
Yeah, and it seems to be a good time. And you know, when if you're not in college, it's kind of hard to understand the, you know, yeah, you're not so under the gun to get to your classes. And you also have maybe an hour in between each class. You're not 5 minutes in the hallway running to your next class. So there is time. And I think that this is kind of a good idea.
I need to talk more about that with you, because obviously that's my alma mater.
And my wife, so that's very exciting.
I would be excited about going to that one, too. So that's pretty cool. So there you go. So that's the news for this week. Before we talk about comics today, we have to talk about facial hair, Matthew. It is the changing of the seasons. It is getting colder outside. It is getting drier outside. So I need my beard products.
I am using Winterfest Beard Balm because I'm now – so here's my thing. I'm not shaving it. I'm going to grow it out. I'm going to get
– I'll believe it when I see
it. I'm going to get as much as I can going, but right now I got – it's not bad. I'm not that angry at it, but I had to put the beard balm in because it started to itch, and usually that's my tell time to start shaving. But I put it in. I put it in today, and it feels great. You don't even feel it, and I think that's sort of the whole idea of – using a product on your facial hair.
VikingOilsLLC.com is the site that you want to go to get your beard products, which is where we get our beard products. And as the weather changes here in New England, they become more and more of a necessity. So there you go. Let's jump into our comics for this week, Matthew. And you are going to start us off today with Action Comics.
Yes, number 987. So we are pretty close to issue number 1,000. This is legacy numbering.
That's crazy.
And as a young kid, I remember picking up Action Comics number 500, and I didn't read Action regularly. I would usually pick up maybe special editions, cool covers, things like that. But I remember reading that sitting at my grandparents' house, and this must have been 1977 or 1978, and trying to calculate in my brain how old I would be when the book hit issue 1,000. Because back then, when you're 9, 10 years old, you know, oh my gosh, you're going to be like 40 or 50. That seemed to be a lifetime ago.
Uh-huh.
We are actually coming onto it. So we are 3 issues away from 1,000, which is a huge deal.
Now, is this book monthly or twice a month right now?
I believe this is twice monthly.
Okay. So we're going to hit that within 6 months then.
We're going to hit it pretty quick. And this is now at the beginning event called the Oz Effect. So this is part one. And the creative team on this, once I flip to it. So we are seeing some people that we have seen in other parts of the DC history since they've relaunched. So Victor Bogdanovich is the penciler. Jonathan Klapian, Jay Leister, and Bogdanovich are the inkers. And Dan Jurgens is the writer on this one. Mike Spencer does the colors, and Bob Lee is the letterer. So we find somebody who is strapped to a board and saying, please, this is so painful. You've got to let me go. Let me go. And you turn the page, and you see that there is somebody there. Now, in the relaunch into the legacy, and actually even before in the New 52, if you remember, there were 3 or 4 of those characters that we would see, hooded characters that were kind of like—
Was Pandora one of them?
Yeah. I mean, there were some characters in there that you would see. And I think right now that this is one of the characters. He's wearing sort of a hood. You can't quite see his face. He's got a staff with like a crescent moon on the end of it. And you find out that the person he is talking to is Metallo. And he's got Metallo to a board. And he's telling Metallo, hey, you know what? You've done a lot of cruel and vicious things. And your hatred never ceases to amaze me. And the fact that you use kryptonite as a heart, that is the symbol of all that is good, all that is pure, all that is excellent in a particular world. And you have taken that and tarnished the name. So obviously this is a Kryptonian that is speaking to Metallo like that. And he's like, you know, and then he's like, you know what? I can help you with this. I can help you with the irony of your life. And Metallo's like, oh, please free me. And he goes, oh, I'll free you. He frees him by ripping out the heart and watching him die on a board.
Huh.
And as that is going on, this person goes over to a board or like a wall, and there's 5 or 6 images up there. And he's talking about how, you know, I've just done this for you, Kal-El, for you, Superman, for you and your family. And you see that over in the corner, there's a picture of Krypton blowing up. So you're definitely seeing that something is going on here. Now we turn the page and we have in Metropolis, a bus has just driven off or a truck. It's an armored truck, has just driven off of a bridge. And what happened was the truck was stolen. It has supplies in it, medicine that's needed for a country. Looks like maybe in Africa that needs this medicine. So the truck goes in, it's at the bottom of the river, and everybody is looking going, well, what are we going to do about the truck? And you're seeing people divided by this saying, well, we got to get that truck out because there's medicine on there that could save a lot of people. And then they're saying, well, what about the people on the truck? Yeah, they're crooks. Who gives a crap? We don't care. If they die, they die. That's fine. And then you have Maggie Sawyer, who's there saying, you know what? I think hope is on its way. and you see Superman pulling the truck out from the water, putting it back on the bridge. And you have people that are talking, and they're all saying things, and everybody's taking these different sides. And then you have somebody over there saying, as Superman grabs the medicine and says, it's not damaged, I'm going to take it right now. And he flies it over to this country, gives it to the doctors, and they start helping these people. But over on the side before he goes, you have people saying, why are you trying to save this guy? And they're like, just let him die already. But you see that they have these symbols on him. It's like a Z in a circle. So as that okay. is there, and of course, I'm seeing it and I'm thinking, oh, it's Zod. But they, okay. And they've already played a lot of the Zod angle in action.
Could it also be an N?
Could be. Could be. But I see the Z. So you got the N. Are you thinking, oh, are you thinking anybody in particular?
I'm just thinking maybe it's somebody else. Maybe they want you to think that it's Zod.
I think that that's what they did. So Superman is flying up. And meanwhile, Lois and Jonathan are at the Daily Planet. And because Lois has kind of taken the other Lois's life. Now, don't forget, these are the Superman and Lois Lane that have come from the New 52
with their son.
With their son. And with Superman and Lois being dead, because Lois was the first Superwoman
yep.
who died in the first issue.
Right.
She has now moved into her life. And now they're kind of trying to move into the lives of Lois and Clark and try to be a family, trying to be normal and, you know, kind of get back what they lost in their previous world. And they're in there, and it is so funny because Jonathan is there, and the guy, there's a guy leaning down into him saying, oh, I bet your old man told you all about me, and what an honor it is, you know, to work with, what honor it is to work with a star. And he's like, what's your name again? And you find out that this is like the star former football player who now works for the Daily Planet. And he's like, oh, Steve Lombard, come on, you must have heard of me. And he goes on, and for like three panels, as Clark is getting dressed into his, in his regular clothes from the stairway, the guy's like, come on, I played with the Knights, you know, blah, blah, and he's given his credentials. And Jonathan's just like, yeah, no, nice to meet you, though.
Right.
You seem like a cool
Nothing
guy.
Nothing against you, buddy.
And the guy gets all bent out of shape about it, and he's like, oh, you know what? He said he wants to – so Clark says he's going to go and find a story because he hears something going on. And they're going to leave Jonathan at the Daily Planet. And everybody's like, oh, of course, you know. Perry's like, look, you're my godson, so of course you're going to be. You're going to hang out here. And then the football guy is like, hey, you know what? How about I get you an authentic autographed Steve Lombard throwback jersey? How awesome would that be? And Jonathan's like, And then the parents are just like, be nice. Just be nice to him. Don't do this. So meanwhile, we go back and we see this hooded guy is walking through a room and he's talking about Earth. You know, it's a brutal and savage place. And as he's walking by, it looks like there is Doomsday, who is in this room. But you don't quite see him. And as he's talking about how, you know, Earth people treat themselves like garbage. They treat other people like garbage. This has not been a very good place. And now you're seeing all these bad things that are going on. You see a guy driving a boat that's having a drink. You're seeing that the people are getting laid off from their job. So all these things that he's saying about how people don't protect themselves is starting to become true. You're seeing a bunch of bad rebel guerrilla dudes coming up as a woman is giving shots to these people, these young kids. And then you have a guy with his son out there in Africa hunting rhinos and saying, you know what? Careful, kid. When you shoot the rhino, don't shoot it in the horn because that's all we want from it. So you're seeing that this guy is seeing all these things and going, I cannot believe how the Earth is such a horrible, horrible place. Then all the events that we see start to unfold. We have the drunk sea captain runs his boat aground, oil spills and kills thousands of animals and destroys an entire ecosystem. The father is in there, shoots a rhino, and they rip the horn off. You see the carcass laying there. You've got these guys that get laid off from their job, and they're saying, you know what? You know who did this to us? Immigrants. So let's get machine guns, and we're going to start killing immigrants. A lot of this stuff is sadly taken out of the headlines of today. But as this is all going on, you're seeing Superman cannot do all of these things. He can't get into all these. But he does get in there where a lot of people, you know, looks like their immigrants are ready to get shot by this guy with a machine gun. He's saying, hey, you made me lose my job. And they're like, we don't even know what you're talking about. We don't work in that place. Superman jumps in and saves the day. And then as he starts going over, he gets to the place and tries to help all the people with the animal, with the oil. He sees comes to the dead rhino. And then sadly, he gets to the village where all these gorillas have now killed everybody, all the children, the nurses, taken all the medicine. And this one little kid is saying, you know, it was gorillas. Superman's trying to say, stay with him. But as he does, he hears a shell shot and the shell drops, explodes. So what happened is these gorillas are very well fortified. They're trying to cover up their tracks by blowing the whole thing up. Superman gets in there. He is completely just disillusioned by everything. And as he is standing in the flames of this spectacle, somebody shows up and he's going, you, Oz. And it's Oz. Oz shows up and that's what that thing is, Oz. And he goes, so I don't know who – I didn't know he knew who Oz was. So Oz is there and he's saying to him, you know, I want to talk, but I want to talk somewhere else. Brings him to the Fortress of Solitude. And Superman's like, how did you get me here? How do you know all this stuff? And he goes, because I know all about you. I know that Earth doesn't appreciate you. Earth doesn't deserve you, but we need to make that change. And you see that he takes off his hood and you see that the dude is all burned up and scarred on one side of his face. And it is Jor-El.
Huh.
And Jor-El saying, I'm your father. I'm Jor-El. So that is where this ends. So holy crappers, a story that I didn't know what to expect. I really think had a great payoff at the end. I don't know how long this arc is, but you get a nice lenticular cover that when you read it, it makes that noise.
I heard you making that noise over there.
Makes that noise. So great book.
All right. Well, we're going to jump over to Marvel for a $5 book that doesn't have a lenticular cover. Venomverse number one. I've kind of been teasing this one because I've been doing the Edge of Venomverse books, which kind of focused on one alternate reality version of someone that bonds with the symbiote. And so this is the actual event that has now started. And we start in New York City in issue number one, and you have this character who is sweeping in, who is a villain, who's saying, coming through, meat bags, watch your heads, or don't. Either works for Jack-O-Lantern. So it's a Jack-O-Lantern that comes in.
Jack-O-Lantern rules.
And he's basically riding a jet-powered broom, and he has, of course, a jack-o'-lantern for a head, and he comes in, and he's threatening people, and he's talking about how awesome that he is, and he runs into Eddie Brock's Venom. And Eddie starts putting the absolute smackdown on him, takes him, knocks him off of his little broom thing, shoves him into the side of a building, drops him off the side of that building, and then when he hits the ground, jumps on his back and starts beating the crap out of him, to the point where passerbys are like, what's going on here? Like, he's gone five steps too far in beating the crap about this guy. And Venom turns over to these people and says, get back. This person's a dangerous murderer. And they're kind of like, we're kind of more afraid of you, of what's going on here now. And so he stands up and he kind of is getting a moment of clarity and thinking about what he was just doing to this guy. Because again, with Venom back in Eddie Brock, it's the whole Lethal Protector thing. It is the show no mercy to criminals that deserve a beatdown, but try to protect innocence and try to be good. And so it's they're sort of returning Eddie to his roots as Venom. And so he's starting to kind of clear his head a little bit, and he's like, I don't feel so good. And then, boom, he gets sucked through a portal like we've seen the other characters in these other lead-up books, and now he disappears. And so this story is written by Cullen Bunn. Ivan Coelho is the artist. Matt Yackey is the colorist, and our good buddy Joe Caramagna does the letters here, and it is edited by Devin Lewis. And so when Venom wakes up, he is now in the middle of what looks like a abandoned and partially destroyed city, where everything looks like it's just crumbling. It looks like this sort of a dystopian landscape, and all of a sudden, there's a little kid that walks up to him. And he's like, mister, can you help me, mister? And the kid looks very pale, and he looks very almost kind of washed out. And Eddie goes to reach for him, and he's like, kid, what are you doing here? What happened here? And he's trying to get an answer. All of a sudden, a shield that looks suspiciously like a venomized version of Captain America's shield comes flying by, actually more like U.S. Agent, and smacks this thing in the head. And it turns out it wasn't a kid at all, but some sort of like creature that this version of Captain America is saying, I don't know what you think you just saw, but you have to stay the heck away from those things. You can't even touch them, because if you do, you're going to be dead. Now follow me. We have to get out of here. They're on to us. And so Eddie is like, I don't even know where I am. I got sucked into this place. You look like Captain America a little bit, but not any Captain America that I know. And Cap is basically saying, we don't have time to talk about this. Follow me. Leads him into the subway tunnels, and he leads him into an area where there are otherworldly versions of venomized characters from across the multiverse. So you have X-23, you have Rocket Raccoon, you have Ant-Man, you have Black Panther, you have Mary Jane, you have Old Man Logan, you have Deadpool, and I think, oh, and Ghost Rider as well. And you have a Peter Parker who in his world never separated from his symbiote.
Oh.
But he's still kind of Peter Parker. And so Eddie gets in here and he's like, what is up with this motley crew? And there is a venomized version of Doctor Strange who is kind of like Professor X. He's been injured. He's in a wheelchair. He's the de facto leader of this group. He is talking to him about there are these creatures that are going through the multiverse and they are hunting symbiotes. And everybody who's been bonded with a symbiote from their own world has been brought here to fight for the survival of all symbiotes. And so he's explaining to him that these creatures are called poisons, I think. And when they touch someone who has been bonded with a symbiote, as soon as they touch them, it consumes the symbiote, kills the person, and then turns these creatures into like something completely different. So as they're talking about that, and Eddie's like, I don't know why I'm here. I don't, you guys like seem like you got this covered. You're going to go out and kill these things. I don't know why you needed to bring me here. I'm not like any of you. And the other symbiotes are talking about, the other bonded heroes are talking about how Eddie is a jerk and he bonded with his symbiote. And so that together, they're kind of a big jerk. Not all of them are like that. But these poison things, when they bond with a symbiote, they're even worse than Eddie. They're something completely evil. They're something completely dark. And so they're trying to convince him that he needs to work with them because these things are going from one reality to the next and they are just killing and consuming the symbiotes. And so he, of course, ends up getting into an argument with Peter Parker. And as they're arguing, Peter says, my spider sense, you were followed. What's going on? And before he can even finish the sentence, you have a hybrid version of what looks like the Hulk and Doomsday fused together that comes busting through the wall and absolutely hammers one of the heroes and starts punching everybody. And what they are trying to tell Eddie as he's trying to fight this thing is that once a poison has bonded with a symbiote and turned into something else, then they're no longer a danger to these other bonded people. They can fight them, but it's these creatures when they're in their base form that they have to stay away from. So they basically say, you can fight the Hulk, dude, although we don't suggest it. We should probably get out of here. So everybody scatters and you have Eddie and Peter Parker who end up getting out of the sewer system together. And when they get out to the street, Venom is still like, I've been here 5 minutes and this is insanity. Please tell me what's going on. And Peter's saying, look, we have to get out of here. Those things are everywhere. Look up in that window. And they look up in a window and you have this creature who their head is almost like just a big mouth. But they're these little creatures and they're sort of like an ashen color and they're the ones that you can't touch. And so Peter's saying, there's too many of them. We have to get out of here. If it touches one of us, we're totally dead and we don't want to wait around for that Hulk guy. Why don't we get moving? And so Eddie starts to follow him and they get 10 feet and they run into a poisonified version of Dr. Octopus, who is now coming after both of them. They start fighting. And while that's happening, the Peter Parker character starts seeing a hallucination of Aunt May. And Aunt May saying, you don't need to stay here, Peter. You need to come with me. We can go home. We can go visit Ben. Come on with me. Just take my hand. And you see that it's one of these creatures who can make themselves look like whatever they want to look like in order to entice one of these symbiotes to interact with it. And unfortunately, Peter goes ahead and does that. So meanwhile, Eddie is battling this Dr. Octopus thing and beating the crap out of it. And he's like, hey, Peter, why don't you come help me? And he turns around and Peter has now been consumed by one of these creatures. And so he now has to face off with a super powered up version of Spider-Man. And that's the way the first issue of Venomverse ends. So what I liked about this issue is that you're constantly in a state of what the heck is going on here, because Eddie never has a chance to get his feet under him as he gets sucked into this alternate universe. It's cool seeing all of these other sort of venomified heroes from other universes and stuff like that. And I like the idea that there's a creature that is so deadly to them that if they even touch it, it will basically be the end of them immediately. And so that's kind of cool. The whole idea of these hybrid creatures that they get turned into, I think, is one layer too much, but I think it's just that they're trying to cover a lot of ground in this first issue here. But I would say that if you have not been reading the Edge of Venomverse series that led up to this, you can still jump into issue number one of Venomverse. It basically starts with Eddie Brock he's Venom in our world. He gets sucked into an alternate world. And much like Spider-Verse, where there was a family of hunters that was going out and hunting the spiders in different worlds, you now have this species of creature that is going from world to world and consuming all of the symbiotes and sort of bonding with them and turning into something differently entirely. And what they turn into are beings that are so powerful that they would pose a threat in any world. And so it's got a lot of stuff going on in this setup issue, but it was an enjoyable issue and it's action-packed from start to finish.
Really good. So we'll stay in the Marvel world for Marvel's Generation, Sam Wilson, Captain America, Steve Rogers, Captain America. This one's written by Nick Spencer. Paul Renault is the artist. Laura Martin does the colors. And Joe Caramagna does the letters on this one. This one reads like a great what-if story. And if you don't remember the original, like the first couple of years, What If was out, where they took some of the very strategic points in heroes' lives and just changed one little bit of it. I mean, after a while, they started running out of ideas. But when you had one that, you know, what if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? What if?
Oh, I love the What If. Those are some of my favorite books of all time.
What if the world knew Daredevil was blind? One of my favorites. What if Peter Parker saved Uncle Ben? I mean, there were some great things
there was
in there.
What if the Punisher killed the Kingpin?
Yeah.
What if, you know, what if Kraven had killed Spider-Man? What if the other had killed Spider-Man? Like, there's so many different ones that I have at home. And those are ones that, as we talk about when we go to shows, if I see What Ifs for sale in a 50-cent bin, in a 25-cent bin, I am buying them even if I don't know if I already have those ones. I just buy them all.
Yep. The worst one of all time, what if Sergeant Fury fought World War II in outer space? Makes no sense. Anyway.
But still awesome in its own way.
This story makes a lot of sense. Now, this is following the events of the secret
Empire number 10, which you talked about, I believe, in the last episode of the show.
So Sam Wilson is there and he's being interrogated. And they're like, so do you have anything to say? And he's like, well, I don't really know what you want me to say. And they said, so you guys all disappeared and then you reappeared. The whole world changed. Where did you go? What do you remember about your experience? And then we go back to the final stages of that battle by the White House, where the combined heroes got together, fought all the bad guys, took out all the Hydra agents, and changed the world. And then you see a scene where everybody disappears, because that was when the world started to change. And this is where the story gets really, really amazing, where Sam Wilson ends up in his Cap Falcon America uniform, laying on the ground, and a guy goes, excuse me, young man, what are you doing here? And he looks up, and you see that it's an older guy, and he's in a garage, and he's working on some cars or something, and he's like, I don't really even know what you're wearing, and I don't know what you're doing here, but, you know, this might not be the best place. And he's saying, you know, I know that you're wearing stars and stripes, and I know you're patriotic, because we all want to fight the Nazis, but, and this guy's black, and he says, but we kind of don't live in that world right now. So you've got to maybe hide the flag. People may not appreciate what you're doing. And he walks out and he realizes that he is back in World War II. So he ends up getting to know this guy. This guy says, look, what, you're about the same size as me. Why don't we share some, you know, I'll let you have my suits. I can bring you down to my job and you can get a job. So he's working as a dishwasher. He takes on the name... What name did he take on? I forgot what it was. But he takes on a name, Paul Jeffries, which was his father's first name and mother's maiden name. And you see that he's just walking around the streets in New York, sees all the posters. It's almost like when you first see Steve Rogers seeing the Nazi propaganda films in the newsreels and getting freaked out, goes to enlist. And you see that the Falcon guy, Sam, I got to remember that because it's part of it. Why am I forgetting and losing it? Paul. So Paul is really the Falcon. So Paul signs up and he's at boot camp and he's like, you know, he's relying on his Falcon training.
Right.
So this guy is miles above everybody else. But he's noticing that he is in a separate barracks than the white soldiers, that there is a fence separating the two of them. And he's kind of feeling the fact that, you know, I bet a Nazi prisoner of war would be treated better than I am. And you see him on a plane, on transport. They're ready to get dropped. And you've got a scene, a battle going on. Soldiers, the American soldiers are getting pinned down. And you've got Captain America very early on because he's got the original shield. The helmet isn't connected. It's more like an actual helmet, no cowl. And the soldiers are getting pinned, and they're like, Cap, what do we do? And he just, hang on, we'll get out of this. And he keeps throwing the lines out, but doesn't have any actions to back it. And then somebody turns around and goes, hey, look over there. And you see a bunch of Mustangs coming, and Falcon is flying in this very crude
wing. So he basically made himself a
made himself the Falcon.
Set of wings, stuff like that, yep.
Made himself a set of wings. So he goes down there, saves the day. Captain America looks up smiling. And then where it gets really powerful is Cap is in the woods throwing up. And Falcon goes up and he goes, you all right, friend? He goes, yeah, I'm just fine. I really appreciate you coming by and helping us. And he's trying to put his hat on, his mask on. And he's like, you know what? So I'll keep your secret, but you got to keep mine. And it's almost like the first time Cap meets Bucky. And he starts talking. He's like, I heard rumors about the war within the war. And he's like, yeah, this is a tough thing. He goes, you're watching people actually die and you never get used to it. And what happens is Falcon starts giving Cap the speeches that he gave him when they first met. And he's given him all the things. He's like, you know, you're only a man, but you've got much more than that. And you're a symbol and you're hope. And he goes, I hope that, you know, you understand that. And he goes, I understand that. And you see that for three or four pages, he gives him this great pep talk. And then Falcon starts talking about the fact that he definitely took the words because he then joined the invaders, helped fight the war, helped end the war. And you see that on VE Day in New York, everybody's celebrating, but he's not. And you see Cap floating in the ice, and he says this is when Cap went missing. So Falcon and his identity that he's had, which is what I love about this. It reminded me a lot of the House of M when Peter Parker got everything he wanted.
Yep.
And he was married.
And then he had to
Mary
walk
Jane
away from it.
And had to walk away from it. So Falcon is now a pastor of a church, meets a woman, has a baby, names it Sam. And then you see that he gets involved with every one of these political battles for civil rights, Vietnam War during the 50s and 60s. And you're seeing that every time he's mentioning things, he is referencing Captain America and something that Cap told him. So as he looks in the mirror one day, he's going, wow, I don't even recognize myself. And he walks outside and this young kid, his son goes, Dad, did you see this? You fought with him in the war, right? And you see a news article, the news story about how the Avengers were on a mission and they found Captain America in a block of ice and they're bringing him back. And you see that whole thing happen. You see that he's in New York City and he's waving to everybody and they're having a big parade for him. He's signing autographs. And Sam goes to this thing in his old uniform and Cap goes, hey, wait. And he goes, you back there, that's you, isn't it? And he goes, you remember me? He goes, are you kidding? He goes, you think I'd ever forget you, my friend? And he hugs him and then they go to a restaurant and they start talking. And now he's saying, I don't know how I'm going to live in this. I'm out of my time. I don't know how I'm going to do this. And he's like, you know what? You will. Same way that you were a scared kid from New York back then. And then you went in and you challenged and you basically won the war and you did all this stuff. And he goes, but if you ever need anybody to talk to, you always got me. So Cap goes and you see a sort of a montage of all the things that Cap does. You see some moments where the two of them are together, that they are, you know, he's counseling them. You see them praying together. You see them going through stuff. And then he sees when Cap dies in issue 25, he's there at Cap's grave. And then he's giving sort of a eulogy about, you know, let's think about what Cap did and meant to us. And then there's a couple things in here that I am not going to share with anybody because it is a lot of stuff that definitely leads into what is going on right now. But what I will tell you, this is an amazing, amazing story. This one absolutely knocked the ball out of the park. One of the best ones of generations. This absolutely gets me excited for Captain America number 695, which is being advertised in the last page of the book. So what I've been doing is before I even read these, I flip over to see if there are going to be new books coming out of this.
Yep.
So you know about the creative team on this one, right? Mark Waid writing it, Chris Samnee. And Matthew Wilson is the art team.
And Joe Caramagna is on that book as well. That is very, very exciting to me.
So that is going to be a lot of fun. And then that's going to be in November. In October, Falcon is getting his own comic as well.
That's awesome.
So got a lot of stuff in here, but holy crap.
As a Cap fan, you love
that. Oh my gosh. This talked to me on so many different levels, but it brought me back to 1979, reading those 50 Cent What If books. and then going, wow, what if that really happened?
I think that's the reaction that Marvel was hoping you would have.
Yep,
with that.
They did it.
All right, Matthew. Well, those are our comics for this week, but it is time for us to wrap our Summer of Dread, which is timely because we had a few last days of summer.
Yes, we did.
As we headed into the end of September, we are talking about our summer watching project installment number two, which is installment number three, I'm sorry, because we did the animated series as well. And we saved the best for last. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the 2012 Dread movie starring Carl Urban.
One of the first, I think it was the first, actually, I'm sorry, the second Blu-ray I ever got.
Was it really?
I had the DVD of it, and then as soon as I got a Blu-ray player, this was the second one. The first Star Trek movie was the first one.
Did we go see this together?
Yes.
In 3D we saw it, right?
You, myself, we went with, was it?
It was 2012.
Aaron Wood went with us.
And I think we saw it in 3D.
I don't remember if we did or not. I just remember being in an empty theater.
Yeah.
And you and I being like, wow, this sucks.
Now, we should say, of course, since obviously this came out, there was a lot of the sequel didn't happen. Super disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was recently announced that there's going to be a Mega City 1 series that's coming to Netflix. My understanding is that there have been discussions with Carl Urban about potentially being in that series, but I don't know that that's been confirmed yet. To me, the fact that that guy, I think he's probably about 45.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way that you can do the Dread series without Carl Urban in that series.
Considering what he brought to this movie,
he became
Judge Dredd.
Yes. So let's get right into it. This movie is fan-freaking-tastic.
Yep.
It is everything I would hope for in a Judge Dredd movie. And it's brilliant and simple in its execution. It is so lean mm-hmm. in terms of what this movie is and what you see and what they give you for story. It is, to me, I think from a creative standpoint, like as a writer, when I look at this story and I say, oh, I like what you guys did here, they just created a very, very small sandbox to tell this story in. And that worked with their production budget. It worked with the special effects budget, and it worked with the small cast other than people who were bodies in this movie that they had to work with. Like, it just all fits together so perfectly because we came off, obviously you had the sort of bombastic 1995 Judge Dredd movie. We talked about that. You have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and decades worth of comics to pull from for Judge Dredd. And what people want to see is sort of the essence of Judge Dredd.
Yep.
The judge, jury, executioner, Judge Dredd. That's what they want out of this movie. They get Carl Urban, and the first thing that you hear from this movie is he's not taking the helmet off.
Yes, and that was the way it needed to be.
Absolutely.
With Carl Urban, I loved reading all the stories when this movie was being made because I was following this religiously because I'm such a huge fan. There were, like, Carl Urban got the script and turned around and said, I'm going to rework this script because Judge Dredd would never say this kind of stuff because he grew up on
2000 AD. He cut a ton of dialogue from the movie. And it's just so good on so many levels. So story-wise, you start off with Dredd's narration of Mega City 1, where you're talking about there's 800 million residents. It's basically from, I think it was New York to Washington, D.C. is Mega City 1. And it's, you know, there's 17,000 crimes reported daily in Mega City 1. And you have one force that is out there trying to keep things from going into complete chaos. And that is the judges. And so right off the bat, we start off with a car chase.
Yeah.
Where you've got these criminals who are all in kind of like a van that is speeding down the highway. And they're all a couple of them are taking this drug that is a very centerpiece to the movie, which is slow-mo. And so when you take that, it makes your brain think that things are moving at 1% of their normal speed. And right off the bat, I was reading that these guys had been working on that effect for 2 years before the start of the movie. And the things that they do when that effect happens is they do They change the color palette. Mm-hmm. So everything becomes very almost like, psychedelic,
yes,
but very bright.
And very it bleeds. Like, yeah, yeah. It's solar flares from J.J. Abrams.
So you've got the motion blur. You've got sort of the flaring. You've got the color palette completely changes. You've got the noise, which I think is a piece of a Justin Bieber song that's slowed down like super, super, super slow to give it that sort of effect. And then what they did was they used compressed air to cause the ripple effect in the skin and the faces of people who were having things happen to them while they were in slow-mo. And you see that in a couple of scenes later on. So right off the bat, they introduce you to this idea that slow-mo is this super dangerous drug that is out on the streets, and it is making every situation that it touches worse. So these guys are taking slow-mo while they're driving down the highway. They're driving erratically. Dredd goes into full pursuit. And as soon as they hit a civilian, he now has the go-ahead to completely take them down and immediately does so. Mm-hmm. Takes them down and ends up taking all three of these guys out. And there's a great scene in the beginning where he ends up following one of these guys into one of the blocks. And when he goes in there, he ends up using the hot shot, I believe, right?
Yes.
So you get the whole thing where he's dialing it up on the gun and you're getting that whole – he has different types of ammunition that he can use. But he just oozes Judge Dredd from the second that he parks the bike and steps off the bike. You're just like, this guy is a force of nature.
Yeah.
It was completely awesome. So then he gets paired with Anderson, who mm-hmm. is sort of a rookie that came a few points shy of passing her exam. But the Chief Justice wants Dredd to, I don't even know if it was the Chief Justice, but his supervisor wants Dredd to take this recruit, this rookie out into the field and give her a field test to really determine whether or not she should pass. And Dredd's against it because he's like, well, if she failed the exam, she failed. Like there's nothing to talk about here.
Yeah.
And he basically gets told, you need to take her out because we think she could be good.
And he has issues with the fact that she's psychic because she has the psychic powers.
Right.
That's one of her things. And that kind of shows up in a couple things where she's able to read situations and read people's minds. So he's not really happy in the fact that that happens. But they get – the thing that – when you talk about the simplicity of this movie, the sets – everything takes place in one of the blockhouses. And the blocks
right.
are these 100-story buildings that are apartment 200 buildings.
Story.
200 stories that have like this open atrium in the middle.
Yep.
Which adds to everything because you need a lot of that because that's where you're looking down and, you know, it's not fun enough to throw somebody in the street. You got to throw them down this opening right down the middle. You've got a war going on and it's become a war over drugs. And the drugs are run by this woman called Maw Maw.
Who is, if you remember, was an old lady.
Yes.
In the book that we read in the Judge Dredd case files, she was the one that was growing the plant
heads. Yep.
Yes. But they reworked her character to be a younger drug lord.
Yeah, and this movie, the whole thing, like, if you think about Punisher Warzone, the scene in there when he kind of comes down that stairwell and just starts shooting everybody
sure.
up.
Which is another riff on the movie The Raid,
yeah.
which was another movie where it took place in, like, an apartment building.
This movie, that's the entire movie.
Yes.
And the movie is, you get two cops that have to go up to the top floor to get somebody out. And now that they're up there, now they got to get out. And that is really – it's a very simple thing. It's a lot like Saving Private Ryan. You got to go in. Oh, now you know what? Now you got to get out. And all the craziness that goes on, all the insanity, no other judges are able to get in there because they secure the entire place. So now everybody's locked in this building. And the thing that I used to really get a kick out of was my grandmother lived in an apartment in Springfield. And it was, I think, 12 floors. And at the bottom, there was a laundromat. There was a convenience store and uh-huh. there was like a little cafe to the side. And I remember as a little kid being like, oh my gosh, this is like Judge Dredd. It's like those blocks because they really play that up that it's almost like a mall
right.
inside. Like there's stores inside.
It is a neighborhood in one building
yes.
is what it basically is. And so when they first go in, they're going in because one of the people that Dredd had taken out earlier that day was from that building. And so he knows that this slow-mo thing is a problem. So he goes into this Peachtrees block, which is the name of this particular neighborhood. They go in and they find out that, like, whatever, on the 25th floor or something, this is where they think that the drug dealers are. And how that whole thing starts is that Mama, when we get introduced to her, she's got a couple of guys who have basically caused her some trouble. And so she decides to have them thrown off the balcony of the top floor, where they land on the ground 200 stories below into just pancakes.
And they're on slow-mo.
And they're on slow-mo.
To make it
worse. That whole descent is completely takes forever for them to reach down, even though it only takes a few seconds. And so the dead bodies are what alerts the judges. The judges show up. Anderson is the one who chooses that job because with 17,000 crimes that are happening every day, there's always choices to be made, which was kind of cool, is that, you know, they can't take them all. And so she decides to go to this place. So they get in there, and within 25 minutes, all of this, this is the first 25 minutes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Within 25 minutes of the movie starting, they have apprehended one of the major drug dealers in this building. They find out what floor they talk to the medical guy. He tells them that this is the floor that he thinks that they're on. What they learn in the meantime, though, is that Mama came in, and when she came in, she went to the top floor of this neighborhood and killed everybody, and then set up that as a headquarters for her gang. And there was like four other gangs in the building, and they systematically worked their way down from the top and cleared out everybody else, so that now she runs the whole block, which is hugely important because
yes.
she has ultimate control over this whole thing. So they go in and they basically get one of her generals. And instead of killing him, they're going to bring him in and interrogate him. And it's that fact that then has Mama say, we cannot let these judges get out with this guy because he's going to go and tell them about our whole operation, shut down the block. So she has a hacker dude that's working for her, and he basically puts up the war defenses,
yeah.
which shut this thing down like Fort Knox and close off the whole block, and then gets on the intercom and says, there's two judges that are in here and I want them dead. And until these two judges are dead, this entire place is on lockdown. Everybody who is part of my gang, get your weapons, get out there, find these two and kill them. Everybody else, get back in your homes and stay out of the way until the shooting's done. And that is at like the 25 minute mark. So by 25 minutes in, we've already had a whole action movie.
Yes.
They've already went in. There's that whole first scene where they kick in the door to where the drug dealers are at, and everybody's on slow-mo, and it is a slow motion montage of dread eviscerating every yeah. person in the, I mean, dudes are getting shot through the cheek. People are getting shot through the side of the head. And that's where the whole like compressed air effect is amazing, because he throws like a grenade in. And when the grenade goes off, you see the guy's entire body ripple as he's thrown backwards in slow motion. And he just comes in and destroys people. So if there was any, I mean, if the people falling 200 stories and splatting on the ground did not tell you that you were in for a pretty graphic, violent film, this first scene where he goes in and starts destroying people, and you'd think like, man, we've already got like 20 bodies here. That was a pretty crazy Judge Dredd movie, right?
Yeah.
We're at 25 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. There wasn't enough extras, blood, and explosions in Hollywood or in England to make this movie.
It was amazing. And then once that announcement is made, the medical guy shuts down the medical center. He won't even let them back in.
Yep.
And now every gang member in the entire block is after them. And so as you said, it is now them having to avoid getting killed, but also once they figure out why this is happening, because at one point they're still escorting this general around. And at one point, after they destroy an entire level of this thing, Mama basically locks them into one level, brings out the chain guns.
Oh, yeah.
And completely destroys an entire level to the point where it's down to like the wire framing inside the walls. They destroy everything. And Dredd starts beating the crap out of this general that they captured, saying, why is she going through all the trouble to shut this whole block down and call all this attention to this place and try to kill two judges because of a drug deal? Like, what's up with that? And then Anderson's able to basically get inside the guy's head and figures out it's because this block is where all of the slow-mo is being made and distributed from in the entire megacity. So 800 million people, this is the distribution center for all of the slow-mo. And so at that point, Dredd says to Anderson, well, you know, what are our options? And I think one of them was like, we could try to call for help, or we could kind of hide out until help arrives. And he's like, you didn't mention the third option. And she's like, what's that? we go and get Mama and get to the top. And so that's what they decide to do. And along the way, the freaking carnage that happens amongst is just like mind blowing.
Yeah. It is violent. It is a violent movie.
It is violent as all get out. But from if you've like for a Judge Dredd movie, like this is not only the best Judge Dredd movie ever. This is the best Punisher movie mm-hmm. ever because he is just going through there and wrecking people. And while Anderson is hesitant at first in that very first ambush that they have where they go into the sort of drug den, she very quickly gets comfortable with the use of her gun, and the two of them are just destroying people. And she's got some awesome scenes too where she beats the living crap out of people, and everyone who underestimates her pays.
Yep.
And that there is a big payoff scene, you know, with the guy that has been sort of haunting her
yes.
for the entire movie. That's pretty great, where she ends up making the guy pee himself by getting in his head and sort of becoming his worst nightmare. But man, some of the brutality in this movie. There's a part where Mama ends up calling in a bunch of crooked judges to the building. So judges finally do get in, but when they come in, they're judges that have been bought off by Mama, and they're tracking Dredd down. And when he encounters one of them at first, obviously he's going to think that he's a friend, mm-hmm. but the guy never asked about Anderson.
Yeah.
So he says, well, what are you doing here? Oh, well, we got a call that you needed help. And so we came in, and Dredd kind of looks at him and says, well, there were two of us, and you never asked about how my partner was doing. And so then the two of them get into a fight, and he takes the butt of his gun and he hits this guy in his Adam's apple and essentially crushes his entire larynx with it. And the guy ends up dying like 2 minutes later when the other judges come in, like absolutely freaking brutal. My favorite scene in the whole movie, though, is after Mama decimates this entire level and then sends in her guys to find the body. Essentially, because nothing could have survived that. So mm-hmm. you go in, and this guy, Caleb, that works for her, he leads a group of guys in, and all you hear through the fog of debris that's all over the place is you hear a couple of shots go out, and then you see Dredd walking towards the balcony with this guy, Caleb, in his hands. And while he's looking straight at Mama, who's across the way, tosses this guy off right in front of her, like basically in her face. And then walks back into the darkness, and you see like him just disappear in the debris. That is my favorite scene in the whole movie. Like he just wrecks house, and then it just gets better and better from there. They finally make their way up to the top of the building, and they fight Mama, and she's got a device attached to her arm that will blow up the entire building, or at least the top 20 levels, if her heart stops.
Yep.
So Dredd's solution to that is, well, I wonder if you're on the ground, if the signal from that watch will reach all the way up here. Let's find out. So he essentially gives her the dose of slow-mo that she had given to the guy she threw off the balcony earlier, and he tosses her out the window, and she goes flying down. And when she hits the ground, the camera is under the floor, and you see her just compress into the ground as it ends, and you see the signal go off, and the place doesn't blow up. And then as it ends, you have Dredd essentially passing Anderson and saying that she should be, you know, awarded the shield after that, which was really cool. But what I loved about it is that their partnership is forged in this movie. Their sort of mutual respect. There are times where she is able to clearly demonstrate that if he thinks about things a different way, there's an easier solution. And then you just have this mutual respect between them. And what I loved about it is that there's no romantic tension between the two of them. There's no romance in this movie. There is two people who are in an impossible situation who learn to band together and just do what needs to be done. And I love it. It's so good.
Yeah, the chemistry with everybody in the movie.
Lena Headey was amazing, and she filmed this in between seasons of Game of Thrones.
Yes.
She came in and did her work for this movie, and she's great. I mean, she plays this character who has she's been through enough in her own life where she has very little regard for anybody else's life at this point, and also for her own. You know, like even the way it ends for her, she's not entirely surprised or she knew the end was coming at some point. You know what I mean? Like, so it's, but there's a great quote from one of the other judges that was hunting Dredd down where he's like, this mega city, this thing is just a meat grinder. People come in and meat comes out the other side. And he's talking about like why why do you dedicate your life to being a judge when nothing ever changes? It's just a meat grinder. And when you think about it, like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
But then Dredd just goes into work the next day and does what he needs to. Like, it's, that's the only thing he holds on to, is that. Like, that is his job. That is his function. That is what he does. And Carl Urban was phenomenal in this movie. To look at his performance, which doesn't have a ton of dialogue, and you know, think that it's that he didn't have a lot to do in this movie is so wrong.
Yeah.
Because he inhabits the character of Judge Dredd so amazingly well. And his to not be able to ever see his eyes, and to, like, for the star of the movie, like, kudos to him for staying true to that character. Kudos to the way that he approached even his own body language and stuff like that. Like, it's all so good. It works so well. And that movie, I had not watched it for a while, and coming back and watching it for this was awesome.
Yeah. The other thing too that I really enjoyed was they made enough changes in the costume to make it not look fake.
To make it functional.
But yeah, and they also made it where it didn't look comic booky. Like, you didn't have that huge gold shield on that said Dredd. You had a badge.
Right.
But it wasn't there. You didn't have the big eagle on his shoulder, but you had a little bit of emblem.
You had it on his shoulder pads.
You had everything there that you know, you knew who it was. It was very Mad Max-ish. I mean, I just watched Mad Max maybe a month ago. I picked that Blu-ray up and watched that. And to me, the movies are very similar with their style, with the simplicity of it, and it's like with the costumes. Because these are – he's decked out in leather. Leather with shoulder and elbow pads.
Right.
And a freaking rockin' cool helmet.
Yeah, man. I hope so much that he is going to reprise the character of Dredd for this new TV series. Yeah. Because it could – with Netflix, they'll be able to do whatever they want to do. And it's just – it's going to be amazing.
Great movie.
I can't wait for it either way, but yep. I absolutely can't wait for it. So hopefully people had a chance to watch Dredd again, or as you're listening to this, it's made you want to go and watch Dredd again. If you've never seen it, holy crap. Like, you have to see this movie. It is amazing.
We are jealous of you that you get to watch it for the first time.
It's so good. Like, even watching it again this time, I'm like, oh, this is so good. Like, I loved everything about it.
Like, there was no – when I remember seeing in the theater
– it's 96 minutes long. It's so lean.
Yeah, and the credits rolled, and then all of a sudden, you're in it.
Yeah.
There was no buildup. There was it.
But even though you don't get to see, like – you get to see enough of Mega City to understand – what the world is like at this point in time.
That chase scene at the beginning, I think, does a great job in showing you.
And the blocks. Like,
this is insane.
Arguably, the blocks would be the most important thing for you to understand in the landscape of Judge Dredd, right? If you understand, other than, like, what do they call it? The cursed land or whatever. Like,
the cursed land.
Yeah, outside of the walls.
Yep.
That would be another story to explore.
Cursed
I'm
Earth.
Sure in the series when they have the ability to do all these episodes and stuff like that, I'm sure that they'll delve into more of that and they'll show you different corners of this world. But really, if you're going to do a lean movie and tell a story, it's not, I mean, you could do a lot worse than go with the Die Hard model.
Yeah. You know,
where you basically that it is very Die Hard with a much darker tone.
With no sense of humor.
Right. I mean, it has one, but it's a real dark sense of humor that it has in this one. So
you shouldn't be laughing at the funny things in this movie.
But man, what a movie. So hopefully you enjoyed that. That is our final installment of the Summer of Dredd. So, and that is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letendry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. And we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets DriveThru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to DriveThruComics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.